Hey, good evening. Welcome everyone to part two of this series on Nida. I want to begin just with two announcements before we start. First of all, thanks to not just folks from Kehilat Hadar who are here, but who have been real active participants in making this a community Beit Midrash experience with lots of people coming in from the broader community. So I wanted to begin with a note of gratitude for that. And also to note for those who are joining us online, we are going to make an effort tonight for the first time to see if we can actually take some questions from the viewing audience on Ustream. We will see how that goes. You'll all bear with us, but as part of our effort to expand this conversation of Torah, we will see where that goes. Okay? So hopefully everyone got a packet, session two, setting up the system when you came in. Anyone not have the sources, did not pick them up on their way in? Okay. If you see someone who doesn't have, share with them, and Benji or someone else can help get another copy in the meantime. All right, so last time, we spoke at great length about the context of the original psukim, the verses in the Torah, about core motivations, fundamentals, critiques. We ran through it fairly quickly at the end. The material that I tried to bring out for you about the gaps between us and the world of Chazal. We spent most of the time trying to really understand the values and purpose behind the mitzvot in Vayikra, Tetvav, Yudchet, and Kaf, which we'll return to tonight. But we did also end with the ways in which some of the direct mapping of those details onto our world is very different. I won't rehearse that, but I imagine that some of that is going to come back again and again in our conversation. Where I want to begin tonight is jumping right into thinking about what I'm calling here configuring and applying these psukim. We saw a lot of data, and we talked about that data last time, and three different sections that had three very different kinds of characteristics. I'll just review that for you again briefly. Vayikra Tetvav was part of a larger framework talking about tum'ah related to bodily fluxes, the contact that people with those fluxes have with objects and peoples around them, heavily drenched in the language of tum'ah, impurity, uncleanness, tum'ah, as Everett Fox translates it, however you want to render it, that whole system of dealing with a bodily state that is either normal or out of whack. We saw the ways in which the chapter was structured chiastically around those two modes, which we'll return to later tonight. Vayikra Yudchet, chapter 18, is a simple one-line prohibition about sex during menstruation in the context of a range of other prohibitions. Again, using the word tum'ah, benidat tum'ata, and I argued to you following Jacob Milgram and others that very much telegraphed the ways in which the command in Yudchet is dependent on the material in Tetvav. We'll see an exposition of that more clearly later. But the ways in which essentially chapter 18 presumes the regime in chapter 15 and then says, and one of the responses to that is also to forbid sex during this time. And then Vayikra Kaf, chapter 20, having a very different tone to it, both a kind of more reciprocal tone, talking about the problem both from the man's and from the woman's perspective of having sex during that time. V'hi gilta et mekor dameha was the additional phrase there, making the woman kind of more of an active participant in the conversation here. And no mention whatsoever of tum'ah. That is not an overlay in that chapter, and neither is, for that matter, any kind of framework of 7 days read on its own. That chapter just seems to be concerned about sex during the period of active bleeding, and you would not necessarily conclude anything beyond that. So the question is, what do you do with those three things that are very different and play out very differently when you want to apply them in real time? And that's what we're going to spend the first half of our time tonight is dealing very much with the core mechanics of how that gets mapped for Chazal onto life. And then, in the second part, in a kind of spin-off of that, we're going to look at the ways in which that chiastic structure in Vayikra Tetvav that is very clear about the differences between normal and abnormal states gets blurred and collapsed in a lot of the conversation around Nidah. We'll spend less time on that, but it is an important way for us to begin to think about how these different categories do a kind of delicate dance of application in the real world. Okay? So, let's begin. We're on page one, and we have two core questions in this first section, and the first one we're going to start with is, so for how long are sexual relations forbidden? I had a basic question, and I already highlighted for you, in a way, chapter 18 seems to answer this question as being 7 days. If you say, do not come near to a woman for the period of her tum'ah, and tum'ah has been laid out in the context of nida as being 7 days in Vayikra Tetvav, it would seem to be that 7 days is the period of prohibition. On the other hand, a person who just read Vayikra Kaf might conclude that perhaps it's only the time during which there is active bleeding. So we're going to see Chazal take a very clear stance on this, but seeing it play out is important for understanding how the Torah doesn't just self-project onto a life of practice. It has to actually be interpreted, understood, and applied in an active way. All right? So, can I have a volunteer to read the first source from the Sifra? We'll read the sources in English for the sake of time so we don't repeat overly, but we'll refer back to the original as needed. Thank you.
She who is ill in her menstrual state. Earlier elders used to say that she should be in state of being cast out. She should not put on makeup or style her hair until she immerses in water. But then Rabbi Akiva taught, this will lead to great tension, and he will end up divorcing her. What does this verse teach? She remains in a state of nidah until she immerses in water.
All right, we're going to return to this text later for other reasons. But this is a straightforward debate over the question of what does this phrase v'hadava benidata mean? What does it mean that the woman, I translate here as ill, because that's what dava literally means, right? In Yeshayahu, v'chol levav davai, talks about some people who are sick of heart, okay? So here there are two views, right? One view reflects the fact that essentially the woman should actively present herself as being in that state. Right? Hadava benidata is not just sort of descriptive, it's almost prescriptive. It's almost as if it's saying she should look ill, right? That is to say, in this context, she should look unattractive. Okay? What's the motivation there? Is it about stepping into the space of tumah? Is it about discouraging the couple from having relations? That is not 100% clear. But it's clear that that should happen. Ad shetavo b'mayim. Until she immerses in water, which happens at the end of 7 days. Okay? Because the Torah prescribes the period of Tumah as being 7 days. Rabbi Akiva comes along and says, that is not going to be a good idea for maintaining healthy marriages. If we have an ongoing regime in that way, where a wife makes herself unattractive to her husband with that kind of regularity, with that kind of intensity, what exactly his concern is not clear, but we know that this is not how he wants married couples to behave. So he strikes down that interpretation and instead says, Tehei benidata ad shetavo b'mayim. She remains in a state of nida until she immerses in water. Now, that doesn't actually tell you that much, right? Because the whole question is, what does that mean? I mean, of course she's in a state of nida until she immerses in water. No? Why is that sort of some kind of interpretive move? So here's what I want to suggest to you is going on here, and it'll hopefully be made very clear by the next source. What you have to remember is that in the time of Rabbi Akiva, it is still up for grabs whether it is so clear that the ban on sex extends beyond the days of bleeding. That is to say, put into exegetical language, it is unclear whether Vayikra Kaf controls this conversation or whether Vayikra Tetvav controls this conversation. That is to say, Rabbi Akiva is aware of the possibility of saying, well, look, Vayikra Tetvav prescribes a 7-day period of Tumah to be followed by immersion in water, and I get that. That's a 7-day period. But I could come along and tell you that only has to do with Tumah. Vayikra Tedvav never actually forbade intercourse during menstruation and has nothing to do with that topic. When we talk about the prohibition, then we have to look for the clearest source, which is Vayikra Kaf, which talks about bleeding. And therefore, a person could be in the orbit of being a faithful reader of the Torah and say, how is the kind of mechanism of menstruation structured in Jewish life? There is a 7-day period of Tum'ah, and there is a period of a ban on intercourse during the time of bleeding. Says Rabbi Akiva, in the context of a text that is talking about intimacy between husband and wife, not about Tum'ah at all, No. Hadava benidata, you know what that teaches you? For as long as the woman is in the state of tum'ah, that is to say the 7-day period, so too the ban on intercourse applies. Rabbi Akiva is saying, you can't take Vayikra Kaf as a separate text in isolation from Vayikra Tetvav. And perhaps even more to the point, though it's not what he says here, it could be that Vayikra Yudchet, when it describes the ban on intercourse during menstruation, does so with the language of Tum'ah to tell you that that is its duration. We'll see that drawn out more explicitly in the next source. But if you go with me for a minute, that in a time of Rabbi Akiva, it has not yet been fully resolved how long the ban on intercourse goes, then it's quite reasonable that he would have to come along and say, Benidata tehe ad shetavo b'mayim. You don't need to say Benidata tehe in the sense that she should be not doing makeup, etc., pursuing all kinds of activities to make herself more attractive. It might be something much more basic. Ad shetavo b'mayim, until immersion, the state of nida applies not only for the purposes of tum'ah, but also for the purposes of intimacy. Okay, that is my proposed reading to you of Rabbi Akiva, which the next story hopefully will draw out for you how that question is still very much on the table. All right, so for those who like stories, you're invited to read the next source. Can I have a volunteer? Tamar.
It once happened that a man who had studied a great deal both written in the oral Torah and who had spent much time as an apprentice to scholars died young. His wife took his tefillin and went around to synagogues and houses of study and screamed and cried, "Master, it says in the Torah, it is your life and length of days. Why then did my husband, who studied a great deal of both written and oral Torah, and who spent much time as an apprentice to scholars, die young?" No one had an answer for her. One time she came across Eliyahu, and he said, "My daughter, why are you crying and screaming?" She said to him, "Master, my husband studied a great deal of both written and oral Torah, and spent much time as an apprentice to scholars, and yet he died young." He said to her, "When you were menstruating, how did he behave with you during the first 3 days?" She said to him, "My master, God forbid, he didn't even touch me with his pinky finger. He would say to me, 'Don't touch anything, lest you put yourself in a doubtful situation.' And during the later days, how did he behave?" She said to him, "Master, I ate with him, I drank with him, I slept with him in the same bed that I'm sleeping on, and his skin touched mine. But he never dreamed of anything else." He said to her, "Blessed is God who killed him, for it says in the Torah, 'You shall not approach a woman who will cover her nakedness as long as she is cast out by her tumah.'" All
right, that's an intense story. I would say if you actually just sit with that story for a minute, some of you know that story and some of you are hearing it for the first time. This story I actually think is as good a locus as any for the fear and terror that surrounds this topic, both for people who come to it more as outsiders and for those who kind of know it very much from the inside in a personal way. It's this sort of fear of going astray of some kind of core commitment that the Torah wants us to live up to, and yet in the context of this very private relationship that is then bared for all to see in the context of this text, fearing that perhaps it goes horribly wrong. And there being tension, as we could spend 6 sessions on this text, right? The tension between man and woman, sort of their different roles in this. The death imagery that we talked about last time, right, that may actually be informing some of the whole structure of Tum'ah now enters in this sort of almost very vindictive, punitive way in this text. So there is a lot here, and we won't cover it all. But I bring it to you here so that we can understand what's going on at this point in time. This is a time Tanaitic text and to show you what is still on the table and what is being clamped down on. It is very important what the scholar's what the figure's identity is here, which is a scholar. Right? This text causes a huge, it creates enormous problems of interpretation for the reason that the protagonist, well, the male protagonist, is described both as being an incredibly learned scholar on the one hand, and on the other hand, someone who did something so horrible that God is blessed for having killed him. Right? That leaves a pretty narrow interpretive band for what the person could have done for most Mefarshim. Right? Most commentators, they can't sort of figure it out, because anything egregious that you would say he did would not jibe with being a scholar, which he should have known that that was wrong. And anything that's too fine a point and too picayune, a matter of law, will not raise us to the bar of Baruch HaMakom Sheharago, thank God that God killed him. Yes?
Would it be possible that, like, he knew the halacha and he still did this? Like, he's not a tinok and shenish bar, right? Like, you don't know what you're doing and you sleep with your wife for the last however many days. Fine, like, you don't know. But he's a scholar, and he's still doing it. Like, come on.
Right, so one possibility that's raised is that, in fact, he is rebelling. He knows, but he is rebelling and refusing to do what's right. I would argue to you that I don't think the valence of the story is quite that way. That is to say, the language in this story does not seem to match when Chazal want to talk about figures like Elisha ben Avuya and other figures who know a lot but go astray. The language is very different than this for the most part. First of all, the very pious language of how much he learned, etc., is one thing. The notion of his wife walking around with his tefillin, portraying him as someone who was very careful with all sorts of mitzvot. And in a way, the gotcha line by Eliyahu at the end, which indicates that actually there was something interpretive awry here, not something that was just wanton violation. Now, the way you often can come to the rescue with something like this is to posit some degree of historical development. That is to say, a lot of what hangs up the later commentators is they, at the end of the story, that is to say, already in the medieval period, assume certain things as being totally for granted, that they can't imagine that anyone who was a scholar would ever have entertained anything to the contrary. But if you imagine this text sitting at the historical nexus of actually figuring out that thing that is later obvious, I would argue to you it sheds a lot more light on what's going on. So what would I say to you is going on here? What is going on here is actually figuring out whether Vayikra Kaf or Vayikra Tetvav controls. Look at the scholar's behavior through that lens. What are the Shloshet HaYamim HaRishonim? That is not a category from any area of law, the first 3 days in the context of Nida, of menstruation. It seems inescapable that what that means is the days when you were actively bleeding. Not that that's the case for all women in all time, but in his case, right, Eliyahu has one up on sort of knowing something that's going on here, right? I mean, part of what you're struck with when you read this story is, you know, she says nothing. She just said, why did he die? And he jumps in with, well, what was he doing while you were menstruating, right? Which the commentators also say, well, he must have known that's what was going on. Whether that's, you know, intended to be prophetic or actually that only underscores the notion of this being a dangerous and scary topic, that one of the first things you would ask when you see someone having a calamity befall them is perhaps they went astray in this area, we'll leave open. But look at his behavior, right? What does he do? During the days when she is bleeding, lo nagabi afilu be'etzba ktana, right? The total distance. And what else do we see is fully operative for him? A whole system of tum'ah. Don't touch anything. Don't touch anything in the house. You'll mess things up. This is a place in which tum'ah is live. Very much alive for this person. And yet, in the days of the 7 days of Tum'ah, of Vayikra Tetvav, chapter 15, but after bleeding has ceased, while he does not go the whole distance of permitting intercourse during that period, he takes great liberties way beyond what he ever would have countenanced during the period of active bleeding. Right? That's what the scholar's behavior seems to be. He knows there's a period of tumah that lasts 7 days. But as far as the intimacy question, that should only be fully operative during the first 3 days, which I am suggesting to you are the days of active bleeding. Comes along Eliyahu, and now if you can hear him being the mouthpiece of Rabbi Akiva in the previous text, saying, no, Ve'elisha binidat tum'ata lo tikrav. You've read the Torah wrong. I understand that Vayikra Kaf only seems like it has a ban on intimacy during active bleeding. But you missed Vayikra Yudchet, which articulates this prohibition on intercourse related to the concept of Tum'ah. And if I could add to you further, part of the zeal of Baruch HaMakom Sheharago, blessed is the one, right, is God who killed him, I think is also connected to part of the value that this text understands to lie behind the linkage of Vayikra Yudchet and Vayikra Tetvav. Get to your question in 1 second. Which is the notion that we'll see this in Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch later. That there is something deeply problematic about a man who is willing for 7 days to say, to view his wife as completely off limits on the axis of Tum'ah. Don't touch anything in the house, stay away, etc., etc. But within the context of intimacy, and perhaps even we might add his own sexual fulfillment, takes liberties within the 7-day period as long as there is not active bleeding, maybe, which freaks him out more than otherwise, that, you know, in a way that's very kind of intuitive and intrinsic. That may be a piece of what's going on here, right? I would suggest to you, though, the best way to read this text is for sure with that overall frame, that we actually have on the table here what Rabbi Akiva is proposing in the first text. We're clamping down and saying the rabbinic position is that, though you could read the Torah elsewhere, otherwise, that is not how we read it. Yeah?
So I just want to question that. If the scholar's opinion is that the period after the bleeding is before 7 days is only an issue of Tumah v'Tahara, why is he refraining from having sex?
Right. So, look, I'm willing to ascribe to this person some degree of inconsistency, right? Which I think you have to on some level. There's something inconsistent going on in this behavior. Everyone has to understand that, right? The person is doing something in terms of these distancing mechanisms that don't go the whole distance, etc. But I think we have to be careful about a couple things. First of all, we're going to have a session where we talk about harchakot and distancing and that sort of whole framework that's put on top of the core ban on intercourse. But it's not totally clear what at this time in a text like this is taken for granted. For instance, even the first, one of the things we'll see is a key debate later on. When she says to Eliyahu, he didn't even touch me with my pinky finger, with his pinky finger. Does that illustrate hyperbolic behavior on his part? Or does that reveal that, in fact, the normative expectation is that there won't be touching even with a pinky finger? That itself is a debate among Rishonim, right? So we have to just be careful, I think, about how much we can assume. Now, what you're asking fairly is, if I'm claiming to you he is trying to argue for Vayikra Kaf as opposed to Vayikra Tetvav, why doesn't he go the whole distance? So that's when I say I'm willing to tolerate inconsistency. Maybe he lives somewhere in between, right? That is to say, he's a little nervous about Yudchev. I don't know. But he doesn't really buy that that's sort of at its essence what's going on. And in that sense, I think what's much more important is Eliyahu's unequivocal stance, which is to say, there's no ambiguity here. This is very clear. The Elisha ben Idat Tumata lo Tikrav, that lasts 7 days. Okay? Any other question on this specific text? Yeah? No, we are dealing here with, we haven't left the paradigm of the Torah yet. Shivat yamim tiyeh benidata, 7 days. If a woman bleeds for more than 7 days, that's what then the Torah then talks about, or if she bleeds at a time other than at that interval, as ziva. Correct. That my proposal for reading this text, which again, I think makes sense of how the person could be a scholar at a point in time which this hadn't yet been resolved, which I would maintain to you, Rabbi Akiva's drasha illustrates. The fact that he has to make that drasha, I think, illustrates that that's still on the table. But nonetheless, why the penalty would be so severe. right? I mean, some of us in the afternoons here are studying the 11th chapter of Sanhedrin and looking at the ways in which someone could be very much kind of within the rabbinic community, but then not believe in Triyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead, and it'll be the rabbinic community's job to clamp down on that person and say, you can't do that. You can't be in this community and read the Torah that way. And that's what I think is going on with Eliyahu here. Okay? Last point on this section.
Could you just address the Shema Lotik?
Yeah.
I didn't understand exactly what you meant there, and what do you think there?
What I think that means is, if you go around feeling free to touch things in the house, we won't be keeping track of what is Tameh and what is Tahor.
And, an issue of Tumah.
Yeah, that's what I think it is. Because Al Tig'i, here it says Bichlum. There are some versions where it says Bakelim, but it's probably Bichlum. The her touching only makes sense in that context. She's not talking about touching him. She's talking about touching other things. Okay? And this, I just, on the top of page 2, it's just very important for me to underscore. I want you to kind of understand what the clear original meaning of this text was, so then you appreciate the ways in which it is used properly, improperly, but inaccurately for contemporary apologetics. Okay? Famous text. Rabbi Meir used to say, why did the Torah say that a nida is forbidden to her husband for 7 days? Because he grows accustomed to her and then gets sick of her. The Torah says, let her be tmeah for 7 days so that she will be attractive to her husband just as when they entered into marriage. All right, again, like many texts that we're looking at, I'm going to, you know, dot my comments with this but not belabor it. Hugely problematic in terms of its obviously sole male-centered focus and the notion of structuring the woman's sexual availability to ultimately sustain the man's fulfillment. That's the language. I'm not sure that's always the only consequence, because maintaining his end of things also may play a role in maintaining her end of things. But I note that, and having noted that, I want you to understand the key thing that Rabbi Meir is and is not saying here. This text is often cited today as making the claim, why is there a mitzvah of nida in the first place? And this is sort of a standard thing you hear. Why do we even have Jewish marriages have to interface with the requirement of abstaining from sex during menstruation? Because, and then quoting Rabbi Meir, it builds in, basically it has a built-in regular honeymoon. And it sustains the erotic attraction of the marriage, absence makes the heart grow fonder, a hedge of roses, etc., etc., etc. Right? That's the way this text is used. As if the imagined thing that Rabbi Meir is addressing is, there would be no mitzvah of nida at all. And why do we have it? Because of this. But understood against the backdrop of what we just saw, it's not saying that at all. And in fact, you should know it's not saying that, because the key word that gives it away is, Mipnei ma'amra Torah nida l'shiv'a. Rabbi Meir is not talking about the concept of nida altogether. That's obvious, for all the reasons we talked about last week. What Rabbi Meir signs on to, we don't know. But meaning there are other rationales that have to do with blood, intercourse, life, death, conception, we can go on and on, but that are the reason that there is a core prohibition. Rabbi Meir wants to know, why isn't it just during the days of bleeding? Why wouldn't the mitzvah of nida just be Vayikra Kaf, like our errant scholar? To which the answer is, 3 or 4 days, or maybe even 5, would not be sufficient to build up desire. And therefore, the Torah extends, under the reading of Rabbi Akiva, Eliyahu, extends the period of refraining from sex for the full 7 days of Tum'ah. That is to say, it is a text that is aware of the counter possibility, already takes for granted the rabbinic siding on the side of it lasting 7 days, and now tries to give you a fuller kind of agadic psychological reason for why it makes sense to do 7 as opposed to 5. Yeah, Emily, you had a question.
I was just going to ask whether this answer bespeaks a situation in which there was already a tension back then about observing the full 7 days. And so we already have Rabbi Meir acting as an apologist, already now at the time of the month.
Well, let's remember, To the extent, when you say the full 7 days, are you...
So the, as you said, the tachdom, let's call it the period post, we're trying to get people to follow the full 7 days, and we're having trouble doing that. So let's... I'm just trying to understand...
Yeah, so let me both make sure we're clear on one point and then respond. I've tried to sort of leave this out of the equation. We're going to get to it later. We're not yet talking about any notion of 7 blood-free days that a person has to make sure that their system is clean for 7 days and only then resuming intimacy. Here we're talking about 7 days total with the days of bleeding included. So he's definitely not being an apologist for anything having to do with 12, 13, 14 days.
Understood.
However, I agree with you. I do think that Rabbi Meir on some level is, you know, whether it's quite over to what I would call the level of apology, or it is, you know, taking a side in a culture war and trying to fight for it, we see from the story of the scholar that it's not 100% clear that everyone buys into the notion that, as far as sexual intimacy is concerned, the days of bleeding doesn't matter. What matters is the number 7. That, I think, is very much on the table, and that's what he's responding to. Yeah?
Even if you grant the 7, is there an argument for why it has to be those particular 4 days? Like, even if we buy, okay, you know, we need this sort of spark sustainer, therefore it should be 7, but that, I mean, you could come up with some other regime. If your sole problem is that 3 days is not enough.
Correct. Why not just have 7 days at any time? Why not have the first 7 days of the Hebrew month be the time of abstention? And that's exactly what lays bare the fact, the failed use of this text as an apology for the entire system. And what I'm telling you is Rabbi Meir never was dreaming of using it as an apology for the entire system. Because he thought there's something significant about menstruation. No, that was never on the table. That is only on the table for people in the 20th century. Right? I mean, that is the thing you have to understand, right? I'm talking about, I don't mean everyone in the entire world, right? But meaning in the Jewish experience, the only people for whom it is on the table that you would be able to completely ignore the category of menstruation and be in this conversation somehow, right? That is a product of the 20th century and a product of many of the factors that I talked about last time. Indoor plumbing, all sorts of hygienic products, etc., 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 that enable us to hide from it and have a hidden culture in that way. You sent me that great video. Ashir sent me a great video last time, which was, you can maybe afford it around, a YouTube video about made by Kotex and a whole thing about sort of laying bare in this these interactions on the street, the ways in which men expect to be completely shielded from ever having to interact with menstruation in any way. And the whole video is a kind of comic and slightly sad and slightly scary kind of documentary of that process. But that's exactly my point. Rabbi Meir thought, why can't you have sex during menstruation? Because you can't have sex during menstruation. My only question is, why doesn't that last 4 days or 5 days or however long the woman's actual act of bleeding is? Why does it go up to this magic number 7? Right? Why is Vayikra Tetvav in play? Okay, yes.
Yes, I'm just disturbed. Like, aside from, let's say, how focused it is on the man, it just seems like it's a very glib way of talking about tumah. Like, in this, tumah is a very serious business, and it seems like it doesn't fully, explanation doesn't fully engage with how serious tumah is. Maybe it's a comment on how serious this attraction between the husband and wife has to be, that has to build up for 7 days, but it just doesn't satisfy an answer for that.
All right, so that's a perfect segue into the next piece that we're going to do now, which is precise. I mean, the question you're asking is, shouldn't the reason be because the Tumah period is significant? But exactly what is partially at stake here is, who says that the Tumah period is necessarily what drives the abstinence period? It's true that, right, meaning there's two ways of thinking about this. One is menstruation causes Tumah, which causes abstinence, right? And in that model, you're right. How can Rabbi Meir talk this way? But what I would suggest to you is Rabbi Meir is revealing the fact that there's actually a completely other way of thinking about this, which is menstruation causes tumah and triggers abstinence. But it's not at all clear, it's not self-evident that the factors that produce the requirement for abstinence are identical to the parameters that are triggered with the regime of tumah. Right? That's exactly what the question is. Now, where does this come most fully to a head? is with tevila, is with immersion. Right? What role? Everything we've talked about so far, we could have said with assuming that there's some period of time, 3 days, it's 7 days, whatever it is, during which relations are forbidden. Who says that immersion is what then ends the period of abstinence? Immersion is from Vayikra Tetvav. Right? Immersion is from a world where you have to immerse after Tumah. Where is immersion in Vayikra Yudchet and Vayikra Kaf? And that's part of what we're now going to see. Where does that come in? How does it come in? Does it come in? And what are the ramifications for putting that package together? Okay? All right, good. So, here we have two sub-questions. One is, how do you know that there's immersion for a nida at all? Because it actually doesn't say it in Vayikra Tetvav. Okay, we'll talk about that. And even to the extent then you answer how it is present in Tetvav, does it carry over to Yudchet and Kaf? And if so, how? Specifically, to wit, it's even if I reach the conclusion that it is obvious that a nida, a woman who is menstruating, in order to be able to go into the Beit HaMikdash, must go to the mikvah, how do we derive the notion that in order to resume relations with her partner, she must go to the mikvah? Because obviously you wouldn't get that from Vayikra Kaf, which just talks about, during a period of bleeding, refraining from sex. All right, so that's now what we have to see, the process of working that through. And that's the second part of this configuration. All right, so Vayikra Tetvav, I didn't give it to you all again. I don't assume you all know it by heart, but for those of you who brought the sheets from last time, you have it there. If you look there, you will find it's very simple. The Zav, right, the irregular emission by the man, is said he must bathe in Maim Chayim, real live flowing water, a spring, a real active source of life. The Baal Keri, the man with the regular seminal emission, must bathe in water, b'mayim. And that's understood by Chazal to be a mikvah, a collected pool, 40 sa'ah, more or less the size that a human body can fully immerse in at once. That is what is required there. The couple that has intercourse, also it says they must bathe in water. Now, when you then get to the female characters in that chapter, there is no mention of water for either the nida or the zava as part of their process of purification. There is mention of things that the nida and the zava touch or sit on. For them to be purified, they need to pass through water. But there's no direct statement with respect to a nida or a zava. Now the question is, what do I make of that? Okay? So at least a few fringe voices in the rabbinic conversation made of that, that the nida does not require immersion at all. I'm not talking about for the husband now. Does not require immersion. Now, just so you understand why that's not necessarily insane. It is not insane to say that because this is a regular, predictable part of life, that even if it triggers tum'ah, a status of tum'ah, one can emerge from it just by passing through the other end of that cycle. As opposed to the other characters in that chapter, where either they're having some kind of real irregular bodily flux or emission, or even the man with his seminal emission, which is not pathological, is still a kind of unpredictable, non-rhythmic, non-cyclical event that it's not clear he automatically passes out of just with the passage of time. Okay? I'm going to argue to you this is a highly implausible reading, and that it's much more plausible to say that the nida is assumed to have immersion by the Torah, but I want you to understand how it's not insane for someone to say that, it's not in the verse, and why you would think it's deliberately not. So Sefer Halachot Gedolot on page 2 shows you how fringe this view is, because it appears in this text, and then a couple lines later in the same text, the opposite is said. So it's clearly some position that is lodged out there that gets collected, but does not even get full voice. So here we're told, flat out, zava zava tvilatan midoraita. The irregular fluxes, in fact, have a biblical requirement of immersion. Nida midorabanani. Now, everyone agrees, as you already see from this text, that a menstruant has to immerse. What do I mean, everyone? Every single rabbinic text assumes that the way the period of nida is ended, the way a woman who is menstruating emerges from her tum'ah, is the same as everyone else. who emerges from Tumah, she must go to the mikveh. But this text is saying, I know that you have to do that, but it's not in the Torah. It's not biblical. Okay? Now, a few lines later in Halachot Gedolot, it then says, U'manalan devaya nida tvila. How do we know a nida requires immersion? Because the Torah compares her to a zava. Just as a zava requires immersion, so too a nida requires immersion. Just as the irregular flux, so the regular flux. And that part of this text clearly thinks it is d'oraita and it is biblical. But that phrase in the first part of Halachot Gedolot shows that this was an idea that circulated. And just to see how seriously Halachot Gedolot takes the requirement of immersion, he says, and if you're in a place where it is too cold and the woman cannot immerse because the water is too cold, it's forbidden for her to have sex until she immerses in flowing water. Okay, so whether that's only because this is with the view that thinks it's biblical, or even the view that thinks it's rabbinic would say this. The point is, it's an institution that's still taken very seriously by this text. But you see this echo of a notion, maybe it's not in the Torah at all. In the next text, Tana Deve Eliyahu, long text and interesting, is it a polemic against Karaites? It's not totally clear. It's people who are showing up who are described as knowing a lot of Tanakh and not knowing rabbinic teachings. And one of the things that those people say, apparently, is maybe menstruants don't have to immerse. To which this text responds, anyone who tells his wife and his children and the members of his household, touch the vessels and behave as you like, exact opposite of the scholar, right? For there is no requirement in the Torah that a nida must immerse, such a person will never get any pleasure from this work. Okay? And finally, just so you see this view one more time, on page 3, the Meiri cites in the name of Gdolei HaRabbanim, and it's not totally clear who he means by that here, the view that the requirement for a nida to immerse is only rabbinic, since it's not explicitly written in the Torah, except in the case of Zava. And he says, I don't agree with that view. But that view is out there. Now, you may be asking, I just told you a minute ago, it doesn't say it about Zava either in the Torah. Doesn't say that the zava, the irregular flux, also requires immersion. And so the question is, why would someone feel that the Torah's requirement for a zava to immerse is more explicit than its requirement for a nida? Anyone have thoughts on that? Why would you more logically, or how would you get to the zava being obvious? It doesn't say it in the pasuk either. Yeah? Great, exactly. The notion that the Zava, you know, comes after the Zav in the chapter, and it's pretty reasonable to suggest that not every single detail is repeated the second time. And this is really the reading we'll now move into, which is the notion that, but to take it into Nida, the notion that it might be a mistake in terms of the substance of that chapter to say, oh, this detail is missing, therefore it's actively absent. It might be that that detail is assumed. Even the voices that think that a nida does not have a biblical requirement to immerse all basically agree that a zava does have a biblical requirement to immerse, even though it's not written explicitly in the verse. And why is that? Essentially because by doing a basic reading of what seems to be the plain sense of the text, that actually seems to be the reasonable conclusion you would arrive at. Now, it's not a far leap to extend that to the category of nida, notwithstanding what I just said, that it's not insane to imagine a world in which a nida does not need to immerse. I would say not only is it not insane, but it is plausible and much more in the spirit of the chapters of Yud Aleph through Tet Vav in Vayikra to say that the Torah is not exempting some whole category of person or thing who is in a state of tumah from immersing when berachatz b'mayim, bathe in water, appears over and over and over again with almost every detail in all of those chapters. And that's what's captured by Rabbi's reading of the Torah in the next source. All tmeim remain tamei until they immerse in water. He's not talking about nida, but he wants you to understand, come on, guys, don't start playing some game with me of, oh, I found a verse where it doesn't say this. Look at how the whole system works. The whole system clearly works that the way you step out of tumah is by immersion in water. And Jacob Milgram, in his commentary on Leviticus, takes this even further, looking at the background of the ancient Near East and showing how all temples in the ancient Near East had some kind of pool on the precincts that was used for purification. There were these kinds of systems of using water as a means of removing oneself from whatever the local notion of tum'ah was, well beyond the limits of the Torah. And strengthened by that background even further, I think it's fair to say that there's a very fair reading of the Torah where actually that's sort of the only conclusion that you would ever reach. The final thing I'll say on this, and then I know there's a couple questions, is we have here also an interesting intertext from the second, from Shmuel Bet on page 3. The story of David and Bathsheba, as many of you know, begins with the scene of him seeing a woman rochetzet. Rochetzet al hagag, right? Me'al hagag. She is bathing herself on the roof. And that's how he gets into trouble. And he sends, and he says, who is this person? Oh, she's married to Uriah Achiti. And he sends messengers to take her. And he is intimate with her. Vayishkav ima. And then this fascinating phrase, Vehi mitkadeshet mitumata. And she was purifying herself from her tumah, and she went back to her house. Meaning, when she was bathing on the roof, she had been purifying herself from her tumah. And then she is pregnant, and she goes to David and says, I am pregnant. Why is it significant? We'll get to the point. Why is it significant for the narrator, for the sefer here to tell us, V'hi mitkadeshet mitumata?
David's child,
then. Then he can't pass it off on Uriah as a one-night stand. Because the fact that this goes to another point, we talked about this last time, right? The sense of menstruation being the end of a cycle of potential life, right? We see the ways in which the Tanakh is very aware of this. That was over. She clearly was not pregnant with Uriah's child if he called her out on the night when she was immersing herself, bathing herself, whatever was going on there on the roof, after her menstrual period. And therefore, David only has one choice, which is to kill Uriah. He could have turned himself in, but come on, that wasn't an option. When you're the king, that's not an option, for the good of the country. But what's important for our perspective here? We see here, just as a matter of narrative, it is taken for granted that one of the things that happens at the end of the menstrual cycle, when a woman is in a state of tum'ah in the world of the Tanakh, is bathing, rinsing in water. Okay, so that is the sort of strength behind saying that Torah itself assumes that there is a requirement of immersion for a nidah. Okay, there were a couple of questions here. Yeah.
So wouldn't you say the text in Shmuel Bet is more than a proof of tefillah, but does it approve the view that there should be no intimacy before tefillah?
I don't think this text proves anything about intimacy because it doesn't suggest, unless you want to read the text as saying, and right, you'd have to say the implausible thing as follows, which is, and unless you think David, in addition to sleeping with another man's wife, was sleeping with her while she was a menstruant, I want to put your mind at ease, he wasn't sleeping with her while she was menstruating, then it doesn't seem to me that that phrase is coming to teach that. You had something else in mind.
The fact that she could come back and tell David that she is pregnant with his child meant that she couldn't have been with her husband before tefillah, even after the days of after blur.
Aha, you want to read it that it was in fact the ban on intercourse. I don't know. Occam's razor, I feel like, demands the simpler explanation, which is just that it's telling you that she was Tmeah. I understand what you're saying. You would have to posit that the text thinks it is possible to get pregnant during that period, which I doubt it does. All right, I hear you. I would argue more for reading it in the more restrained way, but I hear you. We'll see. Interestingly enough, of all the attempts to prove how immersion is the sine qua non for ending that period, no one ever cites this text. So that's the other thing I can just offer. I don't know what that means, but for what it's worth. Yeah.
I just was wondering, you used the idea that it says brachat b'mayim tamei ha'arev a bunch of times, that the text uses it all the time. The fact that the Zavat, it does mention the Korban, the same as the Zav, but it does not mention the Rechitza. And the fact that it says so all throughout the description of the
issues with the zava and the nida. The rechitza is there, chibat v'mayim is throughout. It's a glaring absence of the words. So to say that it makes sense that it ought to be there is kind of weird when it's a glaring absence, and a really glaring one.
So look, this is one of those examples where you will reach different answers depending on whether you are fundamentally approaching this from the perspective of text or from the perspective of ideas. From the perspective of text, you're 100% right. If all I'm thinking about is sort of a close reading of the text, it jumps out, and that's on some level what leads the people to say what they say about Nidami de Rabbanan. But from the perspective of ideas, I would submit to you, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. That is to say, there's just no reason why the Zava should be any different from the Zav, and that's why even the people who say that the Nida is the Rabbanan still say that the Zava is Midoraita. We could extend it. We could say, given that women bleed as part of their normal cycle, then even the pathological case does not warrant some kind of emerge. I understand it was possible, but it's much more strained conceptually. And again, if only by way of understanding, how could someone say Nida's not in there, but Zava is, when they're both not in there? I think you have to sort of reckon that, like, they're clearly doing some conceptual read. And there they're thinking, oh, it's more reasonable for it not to be there for Nida. And I'm just sort of undermining that one step further and saying, well, actually, it's even reasonable that it would be in there too. I mean, I'm not undermining it. That's what Rabbi and all these texts are doing. Okay? Yes, Adina.
Is it clear that Shabbat's not definitely...
If you think it's related to the details that follow, then yes. Otherwise, it's hard to know what it's doing in that text. Right?
They need it on the roof, so it's not right.
I know, but the question is, why does it include that after Vayishkav Ima? Like, if it's just about why was he there, it seems to be inserted exactly at the moment between he slept with her, she shows up and says, I'm pregnant. Guess what? It's yours, right? And that seems to be the fulcrum of the guess what, right? Which I've just inserted into the biblical text. Okay, so moving on here, we're not going to do all these examples. This, what then happens actually is the medieval commentators labor mightily to derive the actual locus for the immersion for Nida. So some just read straightforward as we just did, which is essentially in the context of the laws that we have in Vayikra 15, it should clearly be that way. Someone read the Tosafot in Yevamot. See how we'll do this. Yeah, read the Tosafot in Yevamot just to see three quick attempts to ground the immersion of Nida. It's the last English source on three.
In the place where a nida immerses, scripture does not explicitly mention immersion for a nida. Rabbi Yudai Gaon explained that we derived a fourth immersion from the fact that items she touches are immersion. Obviously, she herself does. Rabbeinu Tan explained that we derive it from the exegesis in Bavli Avodah Zarah. It must be purified with the waters of nida, the water sufficient for a nida to immerse it. And Rabbi Tzad of that here explained that we derive it from the exegesis in Bavli Shabbat. She shall be in her nida, she must remain in her nida until she immerses in water.
All right, Rav Yudai Gaon's view here is more or less what we said, which is to say, if you pay attention to the details of what goes on in the system of Tumah, it seems like it's the reasonable conclusion that a woman would have to immerse. But you see, there were others who offered other derivations. Rabbeinu Tam, a verse coming from a totally different place, and the Ri, Rav Yitzhak of Damkir, deriving it from that text we had with Rabbi Akiva, which he now, living post the time when it's been settled that of course intercourse is forbidden for 7 days, I would submit to you, no longer really knows what to do with that drasha, and gives it a new life, which is, oh, benidata tehei, ad shetavo b'mayim. What I'm telling you is, this is teaching, until she immerses in water, she remains a nida. Okay? I don't think at all, we'll see in a minute, why that's not the original meaning of the text, but you see other derivations here. The Or Zarua on the top of four bats away Rabbeinu Tam as not being the plain sense of the text. And the Ramban goes back to that Sifra that we began with to attack the Ri. Rabbi Yitzhak of Dampier, who uses Rabbi Akiva, Ad Shetavo Bamayim, the Ramban points out, you can see it inside, but wait a minute, the first view there also said Ad Shetavo Bamai. The Zakenim Rishonim, the first, the elders, the early elders, when they said she shouldn't put on makeup, style her hair, they also said, until she immerses in water. And so says the Ramban, it doesn't seem like the debate there is about whether she has to immerse in water. It seems to be with have to do with some other fundamental point of what in what way this woman has to remain in Nida. And says the Ramban, what does Achatavo Bamayim mean? The end. Everyone knows that the Nida is going to immerse. That's not on the table there. That text already assumes that. It's not being argued over or stated there. And therefore, that is not a proof either. So what I would suggest to you, what you're left with, by the time you're done sort of sorting through the battles of the Rishonim, the suggestions, the attacks and the parries, etc., etc., is you end up with the most reasonable claim for there being immersion for a Nidah, is basically the straight-up reading of the biblical text as assuming that, as Rabbi says, for all who become Tameh. There is this interesting Meiri, which we'll come back to, which also says that they reject, there's this view that states that it is a tradition from Sinai and not from the Torah. Kind of compromised position. It's not actually you can't actually find a deoraita peg for the immersion of women after menstruation. But it's a halacha l'Moshe miSinai, which here, I think, as in most places, is fairly translated. An ancient tradition, more ancient than any of our sources, such that we cannot get behind it historically. We can't do with it what I tried to do with the Avot de Rabbi Natan of the scholar and pointing to a crossroads and thinking, as far back as we have any memory of how we deal with menstruation, women have been immersing at the end. That's what that text seems to be, and I think that's an important point we'll return to. Okay. Now, given our limited time, we're going to do this next section in a little more controlled fashion. Let's say your mind has been put at ease, and despite its absence from an explicit verse in Vayikra Tetvav, you understand the ways in which a totally plausible reading of the Torah would require immersion at the end of a period of Nida, no different than at the end of any other encounter with Tumah. Okay? That still does not answer the question of whether that immersion that you now read into Vayikra Tetvav, chapter 15, carries over to Vayikra Yudchet and Vayikra Kaf. Put even more directly, if a woman does not go to the mikvah, is any subsequent encounter with a man, no matter how long after the last period, subject to karet until she immerses in water? Right? That's the question on the table. That's the most weighty question. And by the way, I'll just note at this point before we go into it, I think it's very important for sort of both understanding the text, but also diagnosing some of the struggles that people bring to the text, that the question of whether to refrain from sex during menstruation triggers one set of difficulties and struggles for people, but there is an entirely different set that is struggled by the requirement to go to the mikvah before resuming intercourse. Right? And I want you just to, you could be a person who struggles with both of those, you could be a person who struggles with neither of them, but I want you to understand how you could struggle with one and not with the other. Right? It's actually possible to be a person who finds refraining from sex during menstruation as completely fine, normal, either I think it's a great idea, or maybe I wouldn't have made it up, but it's fine, etc., etc., and be feeling that the mapping of the world of Tum'ah from Vayikra Tetvav onto a woman's body through the practices of Yudchet and Kaf is problematic in a whole other way. Right? And vice versa is possible. Which is to say, to feel a deep connection with the experience of the mikvah and feeling like you actually get to hold on in a deep and cherished way to a world of Tumah and Tahara that has passed from the scene, but you actually, in a very powerful way, get to be a custodian of that world in a deep way. And yet, to feel that the marking of the body during menstruation sends a very different message that you are not comfortable with, right? I merely highlight this for you to understand what's going to come next, which is that the possibility of saying, maybe it's obvious that you do this for one thing but not for the other. Because without understanding the ways in which those are separable, you can't fully understand the conversation. Okay? Is that last point clear? Those are two separate things, at least two potentially separate things. Okay? So how do we know? I want to get your answer now before we look at a couple texts. How do we know? Give me the answer. Why is it? It's been Jewish practice for a very long time, right? The normative assumption running through almost every rabbinic text that you will read is that, of course, it's forbidden to have intercourse without the woman immersing in the mikvah. You know, she's not menstruating, hasn't menstruated, right? A woman who has her last, let's make this very clear, a woman who has her last menstrual period before menopause and does not immerse, okay? And then is, you know, next 20 years with her husband without menstruating ever, right? The assumption is it's forbidden for them to have sex. Even though 20 years have passed, right? Why? Where does that come from? You can tell me what you think, what you've heard, anything. What do you say? It's a pretty basic question, right? Yeah.
You say that you don't think that women don't go to mikvah.
But why do they have to go to mikvah in the first place?
That's another question. That was a question. I mean, that was a question we sort of resolved from last
time. Okay.
Hey, women have to go to mikvah. Do that. And if you say you have to go to mikvah, you have to actually go to mikvah then.
But we actually didn't resolve. We didn't raise that last time at all. I actually never mentioned the word mikvah or immersion at all last time.
No, not last time. But just right now, the thing we talked about is there a bond that we have to go to mikvah after
eating. Aha.
We decide that.
Okay, fine. I can push you further and be like, but why did we even decide that? But okay, once we decide that, you could understand someone ratcheting up the stakes of karet even higher in order to get people scared into doing it. It's always a question of why on this the Rabbanan do that as opposed to something else. But okay, yeah.
What's being established as the practice of the state of tuman doesn't wear off after a while. Like, you're either tameh or you're the tahor or you're not. And so once you're tameh, you have to do something to change that. You can't just wait a while for it to wear off.
Okay, and why specifically in the case of, that makes total sense, right? But in a world in which we're not practicing that Tuma and Tahara in most other areas of life? Okay, that right, that'll raise the stakes. Meaning, but it's actually an important point Rebecca made, which is there actually might be a very intuitive and ready answer to that question that we shouldn't overlook in a world in which Taharot, purities, are generally in play, like the world of the errant scholar. Right, a world in which people are immersing this, that, the other thing, you can imagine it's a simpler road to travel to get to the answer of here's why women have to immerse in that world than it is in a world in which no one's immersing other than women in order to be reunited with their partners. Right? Okay? Yeah, come on.
If we are operating under the assumption that we've seen before that there's like an actual physical uncleanliness that's going on and a marking, then having to go to the mikvah makes a lot of sense, and that you need to wash that off, literally wash it off. And if somebody doesn't wash it off, then they're still marked in this state that makes them untouchable.
Great, excellent. And that was another one of the gaps that we highlighted, which is to say, we might have a very intuitive answer for this question if we were on outward bound on the Olympic Peninsula without any indoor plumbing for 30 days. Right, and then sort of, you know, what would happen? Right, what would that look like? We don't know. We're so removed from that question because we take it for granted that most of us, at least, bathe regularly. Right, and in that context, then there's a sort of further thing of then the mikvah then even becomes an even more sort of ritualized emergence from Tuma that doesn't even though Tuma was never just about cleanliness, but to say it had nothing to do with that is also probably to overreach. Good, okay. Other thoughts on this? Why in a world with showers, no Tuma, etc., etc.? Yeah?
It seems like it's helping to cope with the fear and the mystery that comes along with menstruation. That it's something that helps to put the Tuma or whatever comes along with the Tuma and the menstruation into an order, and it has a beginning and it has an end and has a way of coping, it's a good word, of dealing with this mystery and questionable thing going on in the body that we know about still biologically, but it's still something that I think has mystery associated with it.
Okay, good. So, and let me just push on that reason for a minute, the notion of mystery and the need to kind of recover from that. So why doesn't the man who has an irregular flux, in order to cope with that mystery, have to go? Or, even more to the point, let's even say there's something sine qua non about menstruation. Not sine qua non, sui generis. About menstruation, okay? It's simply a different kind of experience than anything else. Then why doesn't a woman have to go to a mikvah to deal with that outside of the context of a sexual relationship with a man? Right? I'm inviting your response, yeah.
I would say, yes, maybe it would be when it's in the context of someone else, but it's affecting...
No, okay, but look, my main point here is not to cross-examine you to get an answer, but to kind of show the difficulty of answering this question actually comes, there's a little bit of a whack-a-mole phenomenon here where you sort of pick an example, right, and then you realize actually it doesn't totally cover the data necessarily, and then how do I respond to that? And it's not to say you can't. I mean, you started to reach for kind of talking about this in ways we might even be able to spin out further out. It could be that part of that mystery and part of the reproductive element of it also plays in, particularly in the context of an intimate relationship, etc., etc. I think we'd have some bumps along the way of figuring out how that plays out, but we'd have to kind of answer that question if we wanted to come up with some theory of this to bring this together. All right? I'll say, yeah, one last on this piece.
Yeah, I don't think this necessarily answers all the questions that you have with this, but it might also have something to do with analogizing the marital relations with the temple and you know, the Holy of Holies, and making sure that kind of all the parts are purified and have been to an altered state. Although I'm not really sure how it. I don't know how it answers the questions with only women as opposed to men.
Correct. Right.
It really has to do with the idea that sex in marriage is holy. There's got to be an element just for God into it.
So, look, where a lot of the contemporary apologetics, you know, go up on the rocks is exactly on that point. The language talks the whole thing of before you have sex, being sanctified, etc., etc., this whole thing. And then the conclusion is, so she has to go to the mikvah. Right? And it just doesn't compute. Right? Now, what computes really well is, hey, menstruation triggers something serious. We saw that in Vayikra Tetvav. Things like that require immersion. But then, of course, there's a whole host of other things that require immersion. Right? So you always sort of get back to this place of, well, why is it that it plays out in this way? All right? So what I want to, I know there's a lot more to say about this, but I want to just kind of show you part of how that conversation plays out. I'll give you my thoughts on this, but I'm not sure part of what I want you to see is it's not totally resolved.
Can't you deal with the whole men-women difference? Like, there's so many answers you could have to that. That men wrote the text, that their emissions are more common, they don't want to go out in the snow, whatever. Like, there's so many answers you could have for, like, why they would have said it's, like, inconvenient and would have demanded it, you know, for a more regular cyclical thing, but not for their own personal... Like, it wasn't tenable, but it is tenable, like, once a month.
I could understand a sort of explanation of, like, the facts as they're given as explaining that. I think there's two things. One is, you can accuse Judaism of a lot of things. Coming up for a lazy regime for men, I don't think, is one of them, right? No, I'm serious, right? Meaning, like, it's not to deny what you're saying here, but meaning what you actually see is, like, in a lot of the cultures where Tuma and Tara was, like, very active, the men are, like, going to mikvah like bananas, like, all the time, right? And so there's something else. to the extent that what you're saying is we're dealing with a residual vestigial thing, and then you can understand why it sort of sticks in one place and doesn't get expanded, I agree with you. But there is also the question of why is that the vestige? Why is that the thing that remains? Or is it not vestigial? Is it somehow hardwired in? So it's another important point to think about how that plays out. Right? Now look, let me sort of say some things outside here. The text on the bottom of 4, you'll have to wait for my eventual article or book on this, but suffice it to say that the Mishnah there, read simply, without any later encumbrances, actually does seem to indicate that, in fact, the penalty of karet expires with time. That is to say, immersion is required to come out of a state of impurity, but karet expires with time. That's a very controversial claim for those of you who know those texts. I'm sure you're like, what the hell is he talking about? Where do you get that from? But I don't have the time to do it now. I'm happy to talk to you about it afterwards. The text that pulls in the other direction, but I want to show you it's not so simple, is Talmud Bavli Chulin 31a on page 5, where we get the interesting case of a nida who unintentionally immersed. Literally, ne'ensa v'tavla sounds like she was immersed under duress, okay? But ne'ensa can also mean just without intention, all right? But the point is, she was not going into water in order to immerse. The question is, what's the status of that immersion? Is that kavanah, is that intention necessary in order to complete the process of tahara? And there's a debate. Rav says she's tahara for her husband, but forbidden to eat truma. Rabbi Yochanan says she's not even tahara for her husband. Now, the language there is very clear that immersion is important for permitting her again to her husband. Right? Not at all clear whether that's on the level of de Rabbanan, de Oraita. That's not laid out. What's the severity of it? But it is assumed, at least I should say, if you want to be really careful, it's assumed that in a world in which people eat truma, eat priestly produce, that immersion has both effects, and plausibly at any point in time. The next line is what's key. Rava says to Rav Nachman, Rav said that she is tehora to her husband, but forbidden to eat truma. How could that be? You permitted the serious penalty of karet, but you won't permit the lesser penalty of just mere death. Okay? Eating truma when in a state of tum'ah is forbidden, and you get mitah bidei shamayim. You're struck down by heavenly forces, you're not executed, but it's a heavenly kind of death penalty. Karet, though, is excision of a much more serious nature. Now, this line can be read as suggesting that until such time as the woman immerses, there is a penalty of karet, in effect. Right? And that's, in fact, how many commentators read this verse. That is to say, those who want to see the karet penalty lasting indefinitely until immersion, this is one of the texts they alight on. Avon karet hitarta, but isur mita not. To which Rav Nachman has an answer, which is actually Ba'ala is chulin. Though it is a penalty of karet, you're thinking about this through the wrong axis, he's not sacred. He's just, you know, average bodily matter. Okay? Truma is sacred. That's why it requires intention when you immerse. But for chulin, for something that's just not sacred in any way, intention is not required. And that's the difference of intention. That's the frame that's relevant, not the frame of penalties. Okay? Now, anyone know how you could deflect this text as not saying that karet is indefinite? How might you not draw that conclusion? Because, for instance, I'll remind you, among the people who clearly don't think karet lasts forever are the people who think that immersion for a nida is only rabbinic. Right? We saw earlier. Or the people who think that it is only a tradition from Sinai. You can't get karet for halacha l'Moshe miSinai. Okay? So all those voices clearly don't think this. So they had some way of reading this Gemara.
Still 7 days?
It's within the 7 days, but if it's within the 7 days, she can't immerse. So it has to be sort of after the time. So it's good. Now it's good. It's a good try. But you can't quite do it that way. How could you read karet here as different? As not as removing the penalty of karet. Yeah? Go ahead. You give a different suggestion.
Why can't she unintentionally immerse within 7 days?
Because, this we're basically not going to get to, but it was the last part of what I had for tonight. The way the system is set up and understood is that when we talk about, right, once we conclude what we did at the beginning, which is the period of prohibition on sex is 7 days, right? That entire 7 days is in a state of tumah, and only until that time has elapsed can you then go through a ritual that brings you out of it. And immersion in the midst, right? Imagine someone who is actually holding on to a corpse. Okay? I mean, a corpse is a bad example because it gives... Let's give a classic example. Tovel v'sheretz biado. Okay? Someone who holds on to, a starfish, a dead animal of whatever, and they go into the mikvah holding that. Right? That immersion is invalid because they're still in contact with that source of tumah. For Vayikra Tedvav, the woman is in contact, basically, right, with the source of tumah for all 7 days. And so the immersion, in the rabbinic understanding of that, can only come after. All right? There's a simpler way here, which is karet means kind of the rubric of karet. That is to say, the area of law that deals with intimacy during menstruation is an area of law that is subject to the category of karet. And therefore, it might even be the case that details of that law that don't necessarily have that specific application of karet, nonetheless would be treated more stringently. Those of you a little more familiar with various passages in the Gemara in Sukkah does exactly this with respect to, it refers to carrying a sheet from one house in a courtyard out to the public space of the courtyard as an isur skila on Shabbat, right? Carrying something from a house to the public space of a courtyard on Shabbat is maximally a rabbinic violation. But the Gemara there refers to it as an isur skila. Why? Not because you get stoned for doing that, but because Shabbat as a category is a really serious category, and therefore, maybe you wouldn't permit it. So clearly there were interpreters who read this as saying, avon karet, meaning the rubric of a law that has to do with the husband is dealt with under the category of karet. How can you deal with it compared to tumah, where you never execute anyone, you never cut anyone off with respect to just the question of eating truma. That's only maximally a heavenly death penalty. All right, that was a little more arcane and esoteric than needed. But suffice it to say, there's not kind of a clear answer on this question as to exactly what the relationship is between the immersion that is required for taharot and the immersion that is required for ba'ala, for her husband. As a result, you get on pages 6 and 7, all kinds of different sources, which we won't really do in depth, that fall out on different sides of trying to derive this. Very quickly, a consensus position emerges, which you see in Rav Yehudai Gaon on page 6 at the top. If you look at the middle question, they asked him, a nida that is not immersed, is sex with her still subject to the penalty of karet? He said yes. And the subsequent sources try to explain, well, how could this be so? Tosfot Rav Yehudai of Paris tries something, and the Tosfot in Chagiga shoot him down. Rabbeinu Tam tries something, the Or Zeruah shoots him down. The Rambam, which is the most famous attempt at this, someone just read this, because this is sort of what ends up in the Shulchan Aruch. The last source on 6, someone want to read the English here of the Rambam? Please.
What is it the case that Tumar is dependent on faith? Which she has immersed in the mikvah after the requisite number of days. But Nidar and Sabah are even if several years have passed, the bleeding stops. Because the Torah made the matter dependent on both time and immersion, as it says, and they shall bathe in water. This creates an overarching principle that anyone who is tamei remains tamei until immersion.
All right, now you can probably notice pretty quickly by now that even to the extent that you find the Rambam's case for immersion always being required to be compelling, he actually didn't say anything here that proves why the karet penalty lasts indefinitely. And all he told you is that to emerge from tum'ah, a person has to immerse. But he didn't actually close the loop of why does a person have to emerge from Tum'ah in order to resume intimate relations. And that's what the Nachal Eshkol in the next text points out. He points out that actually a lot of these derivations are problematic. One can also refute the proof cited by the Rambam, because that verse is obviously about purities, since we don't say that a woman must immerse after having sex with her husband. Which Vayikra Tedvav, you have to. Right? You want to talk about now going sort of to the realm of intimacy and purity. Well, if it's about, you know, in the context of sex, we maintain immersion, etc. Well, why doesn't a couple have to immerse each time after they have sex? Which they do in order to escape from Tum'ah. The Tum'ah of Vayikra Tetvav. Why is it only the Tum'ah of Nida that one has to immerse for in the context of intimacy, but not the other ones? Says the Nachal Eshkol, yeah, the Rambam hasn't proved that. And so too for the other verse in another source. And as a result, the Aruch Laner, in the next source, actually says this flat out. He says, you know, according to Rabbi Yudai Gaon and Rabbeinu Tam, it's unclear. How do they derive a requirement for a nidah to immerse before sex? Perhaps the verses that they cite as proof for immersion only apply to purities. Then he goes into Rabbi Yitzchak of Dampier, who we'll leave on the side, and then after the ellipses, indeed, according to Rabbi Yudai Gaon and Rabbeinu Tam, only the immersion required for purities is biblical, but for her husband, it is a tradition from Sinai. Alright, that is to say, a straight-up statement by Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger that there are a whole bunch of Rishonim, of medieval commentators, who actually the only fair way to read them is to say, they don't have some clear articulation or proof, the way we struggled with to say, here's how the biblical state of Nida and the penalty of Karet associated with it lasts indefinitely until immersion. They say it. I mean, the Rambam says that. But there's not really a proof. I'll go further. Almost everyone says it. But basically no one has a proof. That is to say, if you look carefully at this at the end of the day, what you will end up with as really the main only responsible answer that's clear is that there is a tradition, halakha l'Moshe miSinai, again, rendered here as older than any source you can get behind, that clearly has women immersing after menstruation and having that immersion return them not only to Tahara, but to their husbands. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch puts this most clearly on page 7. Tum'ata, as long as the condition and its tum'ah results exclude from entrance to the mikdash or contact with its sancta, for so long is contact considered to be sexually intimate contact. Only after 7 days in immersion, or 7 days free of blood in immersion, only then, after she is Teora, does a woman become fit again for both at the same time. That is to say, Rav Hirsch, I think, is reading Vayikra Yudchet the most directly here, and in the way that I was suggesting to you Eliyahu was reading him at the beginning, which is that the immersion of women after menstruation dates back to a world in which that immersion is playing two functions at the same time. Which is to say, one, a return to the world of Tahara, dealing with Truma, purities of all sorts, and also that marking the end of Elisha benidat Tumata lo tikra, the end of the period of Tuma, not just signaling the end of that distancing from Sancta, but also the distancing from intimacy. And then the question is, what happens as that earlier world of the broader picture of Tum'ah becomes more and more vestigial? And here's where I would suggest to you, I really think there's actually only two ways to tackle this question. And in some ways, the radical reading of Rav Hirsch that you could take from that, which is, to the extent there's no more Tum'ah, the entire immersion drops out, or the Netziv above him who tries to read the immersion back into the verse are pretty much the models for this. Let me say this out. There are pretty much two ways to deal with kind of the stalemate that I think we get to at the end of these sources of there not actually being a totally transparent way to talk about the requirement of Tum'ah, the requirement of Tefillah, of immersion, independent of the world of Tum'ah. I don't think it's actually really possible to do that. You can come up with vestigial apologetics for it. You can say, it turns out it does X, Y, and Z, and I want to give those some more dignity. But to really totally talk about the requirement of Tevila and put a big fat X over Vayikra Tetvav for everything else, I don't actually think it's possible to do that. And I think that leaves you essentially with two pathways. One is to basically take kind of, you know, the radical step of saying, in a world in which there are no taharot, all I am left with is an ancient practice. Now, before we emphasize that all too much, let's not be so glib about ancient practices and discarding them, right? But what I am looking at then, straight in the face, is a practice that indeed hails from an earlier point in time, that in fact does not have a broader context to make sense of it, but I do it in order to actually remain in maximal continuity with that past. The best parallel example we have to this is Netilat Yadayim. Netilat Yadayim is something that those who are, you know, observant of basic halachot do on a regular daily basis. It hails back to a world of a much broader framework of tumah and tahara and handling foods, etc. It does not have a broader context to give it sense today, both because of running water and soap, etc., but also because of truma and all the other things that are gone. But it is maintained as a core part of Jewish eating practice as an unbreakable link back to the way Jews used to eat. And there is a sense in which that is one path that one goes with the immersion of Nida, which is to say, in fact, I can't really tell you that there's an Isur Karet attached to this anymore. It's not! There's just not really, and the whole volume on that has to be turned down. And instead you say, but this is a practice that has been going on from time immemorial, and like Netilat Yadayim, we maintain it, we step into it, we give it what new meaning we can, etc., etc. That's one path. The other path is to actually take seriously the notion that women, couples, however we're going to construct that, actually in some ongoing live way, and this is the only way I can understand what's going on in the Rambam and the other people, who despite having no proof text insist the karet lasts forever and ever and ever, that actually that is the place, and then we get into the complicated question of why is that the place, but that is the place where, yeah, the world of Tumah is alive. It's actually alive there. It's not vestigial. Why is the karet still in place? Because we actually, in the context of this one place of marital intimacy and sex, say, Vayikra Tetvav is operative. Now, I think an inevitable consequence of saying that is you may be drawn into feeling that, well, maybe other parts of Vayikra Tetvav should be made a little more operative. Maybe men who have seminal emissions should not take an aliyah the next day. Maybe men who have seminal emissions should take that more seriously and go to the mikvah more, etc., etc. Right? Actually, revive the world of Tum'ah. But I'm not sure that you can do what is often done in our public discourse, which is to hammer home incessantly on the point of karet to the total exclusion of the entire religious world of Vayikra Tetvav. Where to come out on that, I still am very much personally struggling, and I don't have an answer for you. But I do think that the honest conversation around this topic depends on recognizing that link between Yud Chet, right? Let's say the link between Kaf and Tetvav, as forged by Yud Chet, either has to be allowed to be confronted with a lot less hysteria, or has to be taken really, really seriously with all of the implications of what that means. All right, we'll take a couple questions. Are we over time? Yeah, we're over time. I'll take two questions and then we'll stop. Leah.
When you were saying the second path is that you take this all pretty seriously, I think I really understand. It has to expand because if you follow that logic, it can't just be this one interdiction. It has to be basically bringing that whole thing alive again. And you were saying that's the only way you can understand the Rambam and some of the other sources. Do you think that's what they were responding to? Because I read that, I feel coming out of this session that it was actually because one of the answers that none of us quite gave, and I don't know why, that it was the control of women, and that the ancient tradition the reason that they're still obsessed with Kuwait and none of the others is because there's a desire to control women, especially sexually.
Right. So, look, it's always complicated. The control of women through the penalty of karet with respect to premarital sex is a whole other topic and very clear, and the Rivash and other medieval authorities are essentially explicit. They're like, why don't we let women go to the mikvah? Basically, so men will be terrified of having sex with women before marriage. Right? And that's explicit, above board, clear. Right? It doesn't totally explain it in the context of marriage. I'm not sure it explains it at all. And the only thing that I would urge us to be careful about is the notion of men controlling women is very real, but also trades off against a dynamic you might also expect, and I could imagine saying the exact opposite way. Oh, you know why they became more and more lenient about rules around menstruation? Because they wanted to have sex all the time, and they found a way to permit it to themselves, right? So I'm not denying what you're saying, but I also think once we open up that Pandora's box, there's all sorts of other things that come in. As far as what the Rambam meant, I don't know. I don't think the Rambam is imagining a world of all that tumah coming back at all. My comment here is more directed to sitting here in, you know, 5771 going forward and trying to actually own this. That seems to me the only ramification of really sticking with the line of karet. And let me say this. This is the other thing that's important. Here's what you have to remember, too. In the world of the Rambam, I would argue to you, even in the world as recently as the 19th century, Tumah and Tahara is much more alive than you actually realize. There are still practices in Jewish communities of maybe women shouldn't cook the food at that time, maybe they shouldn't be involved in other areas of the house. Men are going to the mikvah in all kinds of scenarios. It is actually very recently that we've gotten to a point of completely killing off Vayikra Tedvav, and that's what actually placed that choice starkly before us, I think, as never before. One more last comment or question. Okay. Yeah, please, we have the last word.
I just wanted to address the point about that you were saying that the PR mechanism functions on a course. And now, purely as a method of religious education, don't you think it's valid to talk about karis as operative for people who are sexually active before the time period expires, and therefore shouldn't we encourage mikvah use as a way of clearly demarcating that time?
Right, so that's a whole. You're talking about might not the response be to encourage premarital use of the mikvah? Is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying, like, you know, this whole literature of like encouraging the mikvah has, you know, the indirect indirect effect of creating a clearly delineated ritual which separates the karis time from the non-karis time.
Right.
Even if we say the mikvah is not what takes the karis away. And therefore, maybe it's not so intellectually dishonest to promote mikvah as a practice of karis.
I see. That the lapse of time might not be kind of sufficiently psychologically marked, right? So again, I would come back to you, but that would seem to vote for the man also having to go. Right? Now, you could say, okay, it was sufficient to do that, and that's sort of the vestige of what it is. Again, far be it from me in this or any other piece of this session to leave you with a feeling of, oh, now I see that X, Y, and Z is not so important, right? That's not my goal here or agenda or even my feeling at all, right? What my agenda is for us to connect in honest and transparent ways to this topic. And I don't mean to preclude in any way that or any other kind of appropriation of what it means to maintain that. And that goes to, again, maintaining the halacha l'Moshe miSinai, the ancient practice that you can't get past, you can't get behind, for that or any other reason. I don't discount the deep power or importance of that. I'm not sure indefinite karet is the way to talk about that, the way we don't talk about netilat yadayim that way, for instance. Though we do with netilat yadayim. It's really interesting as another parallel. With netilat yadayim, right, it is this thing where in rabbinic sources it's like, kol ha-mizalzel b'netilat yadayim, anyone who disparages this is out of the conversation, even though it seems like such a davar shel ma b'kach.
Karis is still in the parashah for Nida. Like, you could say, unless, like, you don't really have to go back to, like, you know, to earlier sources to take Karis out of the picture. Well, Karis is in the picture for Nida contemporarily.
Contemporarily, right. Part of what I think is complicated, and what you see when you look at the Rishonim, which we only really got to the outermost edge of tonight, is that it's actually not 100% clear from reading Chazal that you can derive that point self-evidently. You can derive it, but you could also avoid it. And so then it really highlights the fact that you need to actually kind of embrace a line on this, and I think you have to be able to do it with, you know, integrity and transparency along the way. Ad Khan. See y'all next week.